is there a way for us to scale the relationship between us and the government in the same way as Facebook has allowed us to scale the number of relationships we've had?
The answers to this question and more on this week's Radio Berkman. Here's a number, 103,981. That's how many questions were asked at a town hall President Obama held a couple of weeks ago in cyberspace. This town hall was radically unlike your stereotypical politician in his shirt sleeves while local farmers discuss pork subsidies town hall. No, Obama's town hall invited any American to submit and vote on short questions on 11 topics, ranging from education to budget, in an online forum hosted by Google. And of the approximately 100,000 questions submitted, some 2,130 questions across all categories referenced one issue in particular, giving some of the mainstream media and even Obama himself the giggles.
I have to say that there was one question that was voted on that ranked fairly high, and that was whether legalizing marijuana would improve the economy and job creation. I don't know what this says about the online audience, but...
But this episode of Radio Berkman isn't about marijuana legalization. It's not even about the forum that brought that question to the fore in the first place. It's about the values of transparency and engagement that have swept Washington since Barack Obama moved into the White House. Can both American citizens and the government use technology not just to find out what the other is up to, but to actually engage each other productively? What could a more productive citizen-government relationship aided by technology mean for the fabric of democracy? Gene Koo is a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society who has his finger on the pulse of the Obama administration's IT endeavors. I spoke with him to get more details on this fascinating issue.
Right after the inauguration, one of the first things that President Obama did was issue a directive to all of the agencies and departments, giving them 120 days to come up with basically a plan for how each of these departments and agencies were going to be more transparent with their information with the public. But more than that, also be in a mode of getting the public to participate and to even collaborate with the citizenry. So this is a 180-degree reversal of the previous administration, where there was a very explicit assumption that if there's no reason to share information with the public, then don't. But I think what's exciting about what's happening and what the directive outlined, and it's only a two-page memo from President Obama, is that it takes the very important next steps, which are not just make information available, because there is a lot of information available out there, but think about how that information and how governance can be more a partnership with citizenry, not just kind of two parties sitting at opposite ends of a very long table, kind of handing data to each other across that very long table.
So how has this worked so far? What kind of tools and practices have come out of the woodwork of this two-page memo?
I think one of the most high-profile things that has been going on was a virtual town hall that took place last week. In fact, this was happening even during the transition. There were a bunch of different tools, technological tools and web-based tools that then President-elect Obama and his team were using to get questions submitted from the general citizenry. This took that one step further and turned it into a live event. What they also did was they had the responses come live from President Obama in a kind of a more traditional town hall format, but with the first five or six questions were submitted via the internet rather than through people sitting in the town hall setting that kind of is the usual setup for these kinds of things. So those are two high profile examples that kind of set the tone. And I think it's using the idea more as a bully pulpit. Are these efforts really going to create that much more engagement with government? I think as a practical matter, no, because the policies that are going to have to be passed in the next few years in response to some of the questions that were asked are very, very intricate. And, you know, to get involved in those would require some really serious commitment on the part of citizens. But what I think it does do is set expectations for how government should act and also sets expectations for what citizens should be doing vis-a-vis their governments.
There's an aspect to this that seems we're emerging from a dark age of citizen participation. There's also a lot of capacity building that probably has to be done to make this really work.
Right, absolutely. Well, I mean, so there's two. So to respond to the first thing that you said, I think what's interesting to me is that in some ways, if the last 8 years were kind of a dark era in terms of government openness, and it would be hard to argue that it wasn't, that actually in some ways is what galvanizes so much interest and excitement around openness now. It's because there was so much resistance to that citizens did come together and begin recognizing and valuing that openness is important. So sometimes you have to have something taken away from you to realize, wow, that's something we really care about. Because, you know, openness, transparency, these are the kinds of things that we all kind of care a little bit about, but not usually the kinds of things we get really passionate about. Losing your job, that's the kind of thing that causes you to go out there and protest or even riot. But, you know, not getting an answer to your FOIA request, I mean, that's the kind of thing that, you know, matters quite a bit to a small number of people. But we began to see why it should matter to a lot of us. Especially when you look at, as we're linking things like how the banking sector did a lot of things in secret, you know, why it matters that things should actually be open and public becomes more obvious. As to the question of infrastructure, I think it's true that the web population is, and the group of, the kinds of people who would want to submit questions to something like this town hall setting is not reflective of the general population. I don't know that it has to be. You know, especially if it's a population that normally wouldn't participate in some other mechanism, such as writing letters. You know, my mother-in-law actually emailed me to let me know that she had submitted a question to this virtual town hall, which I think is really, really significant. I mean, she's not an IT person. She's a physical therapist. So that's about as she almost never, I mean, she uses a computer to submit, you know, reports to her bosses. But most of the day she's driving around and, you know, being like doing a very physical job and not a very kind of desk job with 24 hour access to the computer. So I think that really shows that there are people who really do want to participate. And so, yes, we do need to work on developing infrastructure, and not just in terms of getting better computer access and broadband access, because, you know, it didn't take very much to access this piece of software, but more kind of a cultural willingness to engage, and the idea that it's actually a very interesting and good way to interact with government.
You pointed out some specific things in a blog post last week about what the administrators of this virtual town hall could do to make this more valuable. And you found out these things because of a particular incidence of questions bubbling to the top.
Sure, absolutely. Well, this has generated a lot of kind of debate back and forth. A lot of the questions that ended up bubbling up in across these different categories that were laid out, such as jobs and green jobs and healthcare, ended up being about marijuana. And the joke that Obama tried to crack during the town hall where he addressed this was, you know, maybe that's just reflective of what the internet population is interested in. And there was some pretty strong reaction to that, and that maybe he shouldn't have kind of dismissed that particular constituency so offhandedly. I mean, drugs are an important question, and our drug policy is an important question, and it's one of the major cornerstones of what's happening in Mexico right now in terms of the violence and a lot of the blame being pointed north of the border to us in terms of, well, where is the demand for all these drugs coming from? It's largely from Americans. So so it is, in fact, a very important question. The question, though, as far as this town hall was concerned, is whether it was a legitimate use of that town hall. And in many ways, because the town hall was structured around economic questions, things like healthcare, there were basically efforts to kind of jam questions about marijuana and legalization of drugs in general into topics that were kind of orthogonal to the actual topic.
And this isn't the first time something's like this happened. It just happens to be online.
This particular happens to be online, and
history where
exactly
a small motivated group, and
I don't know how small the group is, and I don't know how, you know, clearly they're motivated, and clearly they understand how to use the technology in such a way that their message gets heard. I think you have to start with, what was the point of this town hall? And there are a few different reasons why you would hold a town hall, and you would want to. Some of them you look at from the perspective of the administration. Some you look at the perspective of the citizenry or of democracy as a whole, as a more abstract concept. From the perspective of the administration and somebody who's trying to push a particular agenda, you want to take a lot of these issues that are really, really highly abstract and make them human, because very few people are kind of policy wonks who really want to dig into statistics and numbers and how does this particular, you know, marginal tax rate affect you and the person next door to you and therefore the entire economy and therefore you do or don't have a job next year. You know, these are so abstract that it's really hard for most people to get. And I think one of the valuable things that town halls did was be able to introduce human faces and human stories to connect to what would otherwise be very abstract policy questions. Another is to have that kind of genuine conversation, you know, and have new ideas pop up, in which case this, you know, this kind of bubbling up of the drug policy question is a great thing. Another is that the citizenry feels empowered and a part of government. And you can say that very cynically, like, you know, this is a way to kind of mollify the masses. But kind of taking a broader perspective, you have to realize that democracy is kind of a faith-based governmental system. It only works when everybody thinks that they have some kind of effect or impact on the democracy. If people start believing that, you know, nothing's under their control, then why should they bother to vote, and why should they call their senator? Pretty soon that becomes true. Another is to connect citizens with each other. So, you know, having forums, having commons, having spaces where people come together and find their common interests, where the government just happens to be one motivating factor for everybody to show up. But then they kind of get together and form their own things and then go out and, you know, put pressure on the government from outside or support policies or whatever it is that they do. That's another really, really important facet of especially American democracy. We rely so heavily on not just engaged citizenry, which implies that each of us kind of are lone citizens, kind of doing our own little thing, you know, casting our own ballots, making our own phone calls, but that we're actually associations of people who get together, who together want things to be done. And there's a very different relationship between us as groups of citizens to the government versus just us as individual citizens to the government. So these kinds of public spaces can often be important opportunities for those kinds of groups to come together. I'd be very curious whether the marijuana questions were the outcome of a group of organized people or were kind of more spontaneous individuals or kind of the spark for what might be, end up being an even bigger movement in the future.
How does this fit in with the model of how an issue gets on the president's agenda? You know, an idea comes across his table and he says, I think this is great. I think we need to take this on. And enough people have bugged me about this that we need to start a task force and, you know, get some people employed, start a department.
Right. That's a good question. And I can't answer for, I mean, I'm sure it's completely different from president to president. I also am sure that people come in with their own agendas, but then kind of events can overtake them. George Bush didn't sit down and say, well, let's make terrorism our number one issue. It happened to him. If it's not already, you know, top of the agenda, then it does take kind of pretty strong citizen pressure. But I think going to the technology here, one of the key problems we face right now is how to scale democracy from its origins when we were kind of more agrarian and village-based society when the Constitution was written, to what has become a massively urban, not massively urban, but just a much larger population. And when you think about the relationship that you and I have with our senator, we're talking about millions of people per one representative. That becomes impossible. I mean, it's not really possible for the senator, or even in a lot of places for the congressman, to come around and get to know their actual constituents. Is there a way for us to scale the relationship between us and the government in the same way as Facebook has allowed us to scale the number of relationships we've had? If because of Facebook I can keep tabs on 400 people Whereas before, I can only really keep track of 50 in terms of what are they doing. You know, it would be interesting to see, can we have basically our political representatives also scale the number of relationships they can have with their constituents from the more personal style that they had before to something a little bit more leveraged using technology. And I think that's very difficult because, culturally speaking, politicians often get to where they are because they're kind of face-to-face glad handlers. They really like people. And you know, Bill Clinton's a great example of somebody who can just walk into the room and instantly just electrify the whole place. You kind of lose that advantage often. There's a different kind of personality that sparkles online. So there's good reason, I think, personality-wise, for people who are really successful in face-to-face relationships to kind of be cautious about, can they do the same thing? And yet, I'm not very cynical about this stuff. I really do think that a lot of politicians do want to be in touch with their constituents. If you want to be cynical about it, you could say they're doing it because they want to get your vote, but that's exactly the whole point, isn't it? So the big question we face as far as American democracy is concerned is, can technology help us overcome some of the dysfunctions that have cropped up over the past decades that have to do with scale in terms of population and the ratio of constituents to representatives that we now have, and also have to do with the scale of the complexity of the problems we face. Over the last few decades, increasingly the power has begun shifting from legislation over to administrative rulemaking. And so that when Congress passes a law that needs to be enforced by the EPA, the EPA then has its own process for how to actually instantiate that law into a set of rules and regulations. And that's often where the heaviest lobbying happens. It's not just in Congress where you're trying to get the congressman to stick in a couple of million dollars for your pet project, but then, you know, on all these rules and regulations that affect industry and businesses, you then end up having the lobbyists also going to the rulemaking sessions and influencing how the laws get turned into rules and regulations that are actually enforced. You know, Congress might just pass a law that says, well, you know, take water samples every year. And then the EPA has to figure out, well, what does that mean? Like, what kinds of water samples, you know, and to what level of quality? And when you define those things, then you pretty much are starting to define who can be hired for that job and who can't. And then who's in trouble when the water quality is found bad and who's not. And that's where a lot of lobbying effort has gone. These processes have been transparent. The notice and comment process of the public having input into the rulemaking, these are all transparent. They're open to the public. You can walk into these rulemaking sessions. You can stand up and you can submit your testimony. You can write your own, you know, memos and advocacy. But transparency hasn't really helped us solve this problem. Transparency is not enough. Simply making the process open has not been enough because, again, going back to the idea of complexity or the idea of the organized few being more powerful than the disorganized many, your average citizen does not have the expertise needed to go in there and say something meaningful. Industry lobbyists who make it their job to know everything there is to know about that particular topic and for whom millions of dollars are at stake, as opposed to your average citizen where maybe $10 are at stake, they're going to be the ones with the motivation to go in there and influence the laws. And that's what's often called agency capture, which is the industry ends up capturing the agency during this process. And there's a very big open question, will the internet help us aggregate those small little bits of interest that you and I have in things like, let's say, EPA rulemaking or FDA rulemaking about the health and safety of our food? You and I, you know, have a little bit of stake until we get salmonella, and then we have a lot at stake.
Yeah, our stake is apportioned out over generations.
It's apportioned out over time. It's apportioned out over a huge population. Legislators who are trying to pass thousands of laws, they don't have the time and expertise, even with all of their staff, to be experts in the science and other aspects of the laws that they're trying to pass. So the point was, let's delegate this and try to get the public involved because we believe the public and people at large have this knowledge. So the theory behind rulemaking was always the wisdom of the crowds. The internet comes along and maybe we can actually tap into that wisdom for the first time. I'm not sure that the big question that people have is, does the internet kind of just simply focus more attention on what everybody cares about? So if you look at the top Google searches or the top most emailed articles on the New York Times, they're not the esoteric articles. It's not, you know, it's not the long tail stuff. It's stuff that everybody was already kind of reading too much of, you might say, and now reading more of. It's the neglected issues that are the ones that are most ripe for capture by industry interests, because there's no citizenry sitting on the other side saying, no, these are our interests. The question is, can we actually not just farm out this, not just have the wisdom of the crowds, but also the interest of the crowds? Can we get them to actually pay attention to what's going on? Can we disperse that interest so that instead of having so much attention focused on that one issue, can't we kind of split up all that attention and have people focus on different aspects of it? It may turn out to be impossible. But that's one big question that faces us in terms of, will the internet actually help us overcome this issue?
I mean, this is a technology that's putting citizens to work on asking some of the neglected questions, as you say, but also there's a potential to get the citizens to do the work of, you know, creating the answers.
That's exactly, yeah. And that, I think, is what's so wonderful about American democracy, is that's been we do have this strong belief that the best answers lie among the people themselves. Because I think one of the big things that also Obama comes in with is the idea that, despite what I just said, there are some things that only government can do. And that was something that previous administrations may have been in denial about, and a different ideology that prevailed was the idea that, you know what, government is actually an evil that we should just try to get rid of as much as possible. And we're beginning to recognize that, well, you know, there's a reason why we have government. There are some things that we just simply can't do for ourselves that we require a national or international response to. And it's the coupling of that understanding with, at the same time, holding onto the value that, yet we also still believe that innovation and power rests with the people. These are seemingly contradictory ideas. But if you can tether them together, then you get significantly more sophisticated, nuanced, and powerful answers to the problems that face us than if you just simply said, all the power lies with the government, we need to, you know, kind of empower the government to do things for us, or to say, government sucks, we need to get rid of it, let's get people to do things for themselves. Those are both naive and simplistic. And what we're trying to figure out right now is, how do you engage people in this problem solving in partnership with government, in a robust partnership with government? Can technology help us build that robust partnership in a way that we haven't been able to do in the past? Maybe we haven't needed to do because of the, you know, kind of less complicated problems we used to face, or because of the smaller number of people we used to have. We really need this technology to help us bring back, in a sense, some of the values that we've held, but also make new things possible that we never could have imagined 100 years ago, such as crowdsourcing problems and using the wisdom of the crowds to find solutions.
Well, I'd be interested to talk to you in the future about reflecting back on the Stone Age we're currently in.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gene Koo is a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. You can follow his blog at blogs.law.harvard.edu/AnderKoo. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can subscribe to Radio Berkman and find more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.